Yeah, good morning, everyone. I've followed Simon, I think, two or three times now, talking along things of a similar vein, and without fail, he always does the groundwork superbly for me. He raises all of the questions that I needed to speculate about in the first couple of minutes of my presentation. So once again, thank you, Simon. You have made my life greatly easier, and actually it's kind of convenient because he has led into many of the issues that lay behind the sorts of work that we're starting to undertake with Thompson here. So I might spend just a couple of minutes talking about some of the background to those issues, and then we can leap into where we're actually going forwards. Like many places around the country, as Simon alluded to, we certainly have many silos of information at the back end. Our approach to developing the kinds of research profile and researcher identity that he described is exactly that. We build a complex entity based on facets of things drawn from many different systems. We aggregate it together and then produce something that can be described as a large backpack, if you like, into which we stuff all of the bits and pieces that we know about an individual researcher, including details about their publications, about the rest of the work flow that goes on at the university. And then we build on that in terms of internal things, internal systems, internal sources of data to do with grants, to do with publications, and try and apply some of that to the structure of the university to build the same sorts of facets, the same sorts of views that you would have seen in Simon's find an expert. When we're doing so, of course, we came across many of the sorts of issues that have been talked about across the sector for the last couple of years. How do we deal with the idea of finding unique identity? Do we need to create and track where these things are coming from? We need to do so in a nice, secure, policy-based way. We need to be able to express these coherently in a way that lets us tell other people the rules by which we are determining whether or not we're going to expose information. Are we going to track it back? Do we need to think about where some of these sources of information come from? And then we started to look at, in terms of some recent experiences, building data sets in preparation for the RQF, the issues of mobility, of quality of data, of getting the right sort of data recruited, and how we do so in an environment, as Tim said, with great mobility of researchers, where quite frequently people are rocking up to the university and saying, hey, I'm here, and we're not knowing everything we would like to know about them. And that's where, in many ways, the opportunity came up for us to work with Thomson Reuters in building some tools and some processes that are going to deliver some fairly significant advantage to us. And I guess, as in any good partnerships, there are payoffs to both sides. From the university's point of view, certainly there are some very clear advantages in the approaches that we've chosen. And Jiho's going to talk to some of the advantages from the Thomson Reuters point of view as well. So this was, for me, I think the key part about the workshop today that really summed up where we wanted to go. So let's leap in. Everyone's seen repositories. Like everyone else, we have a reasonably well-defined, robust repository. We collect a great deal of publications data in the repository. And much of it, in the early days, was input on a voluntary basis. When we came to undertake a lot of the development work we were doing in support of the RQF, we immediately ran into the problem of content recruitment. How on earth were we going to accept and find all of the data about the publications that we needed to, about all of the researchers that were going to be involved in a manner and a timely fashion, which would actually enable us to populate the repository and get it done accurately, and do so in a way that we could actually effectively engage with the researcher population at the university without coming along with a big stick and beating them and saying, hey, by the way, the Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research says you've got to put all these things in. And we came across a variety of methods. Some of it was assisted, some of it was mediated. Of course, we have those champions who are busy recruiting data and busy inputting their own publications because they can see the benefits in doing so. But we also said, well, okay, let's look at what other sources of data are there out there that we can deal with, that we can accept and massage and get into the system. Some of those came in the forms of other external data sources, like the Thomson ISI data, like the National Citation Reports. Some of it was held in departmental publication records. Some of it came to us in the form of EndNote libraries. So there was a very wide variety of sources that we wanted to deal with in terms of getting data into the repository. And then, as Simon mentioned, on top of that, we build other things. So where do we go from the repository is into the realm of the research profile, the researcher profile, where we start to bring some of these data sources together, add richness to the product, and start to build something which describes the rounded picture of what is actually going on inside the university's research efforts. Still, all in all, there is a lot of manual intervention involved. And rather than go with a mandate, it is very much a process of volunteering, cajoling, sometimes coercing, but most often assisting and working in partnership with the individuals to develop their profile on our systems. Simon was very kind and gave us a good plug for UQ researchers. And the same sorts of data that you would see on the Melbourne site, you'll see here too. Contacts, biographical data, the groups they're working with, the publications list, of course, students that they supervise, colleagues that they collaborate with, grants, projects, and a whole host of information that is drawn from all of those individual systems. One of the particular aspects that we were interested in doing this year was trying to drive efficiencies in our reporting processes, and Simon talked very eloquently about reducing the stresses on the workplace at the university that are built around reporting information to external bodies. For us, a really significant thing was being able to get all of that data in place for our HERDIC collection this year, and for the first time we did it all entirely out of the repository. So we didn't use an external research reporting system for this. All of our publications reporting was done solely using the data that we've been able to recruit. And that was a big thing for us to do. So what do we do about bringing it all together? Well, certainly dealing with institutional systems in itself inside is a tough enough task, but what about when you start to want to pull in things from elsewhere? What about bringing some of that additional richness in terms of metrics and reporting and impact and bringing that back and using that internally? How do we know that the data we're talking about in our repository is the same data that we're seeing in the researcher profile, that we're seeing when we do a search inside something like ISI, that we do the same search in Google Scholar, and you start to see differences in quality, differences in accuracy, and thinking about how do we make that the same? How do we deal with making sure that the information sources are accurate and that we bring it together as easily as we can? How do we get buy-in? How do we get academics on board? And we do that by making it, I guess, as easy as possible for them. We make it as seamless a process as possible for them. We do so in one place. We don't ask them to enter data two or three or four times. We make it easy and even desirable when we start to talk about some of the ancillary benefits that flow on from that. And that was one, I guess, the point at which we saw and recognised the opportunity to work with Thomson to build workflows based around the Researcher ID product, which I think you're going to talk about now, eh?
Yeah, thanks, Andrew.
All right.
Well, good morning, everyone. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Gino, and I'm from Wollongong in Sydney. So I'm following on from Andrew, and just talking about one of the new initiatives from Thomson called Researcher ID. Now, when we talk about the problem of author ambiguity, well, how big a problem is it? And we looked through Web of Science and did a quick search on some of the top common, most common author names that come up. And you can see what a big issue it is. There's 300,000 Smiths, 313,000 Lees. Now, if you're looking for an Asian name, God help you, because for a population of 1 billion, I think it's around 20 surnames that contribute to 90% of that population's names. So it is a very, very difficult challenge and something that Thomson has been working on for a number of years. Now, we started off by trying to help users search for a right author with a guided search, so giving them some hints saying, hey, what institutions do they come from? What fields are they looking? So that was one of the first steps. And the second step was looking at, well, can we use some of the tools that we have and create an algorithm to cluster together articles that we think are the same author, is the same author, and present those to you? So the users provided us some positive feedback on these initiatives, but they actually said, you know, hey, what? We want some more. Can you give us a unique identifier and link that identifier to all our works? Now, one of the other issues, apart from just the names, common names, is, well, people are now authoring with authors from all over the world. And if you look at these two graphs, they'll show you, again, the number of countries that they author with is on the rise, and the same with the number of authors per paper. So it is a big challenge, and certainly another issue is, well, how do researchers find their collaborators? So Researcher ID was really trying to look at all of these issues and come up with something that we could provide as a vendor. So what is Researcher ID? Let me just make sure I've got all the things up. That's a registry that assigns a researcher with a unique identifier. And it's a persistent identifier with a persistent location where a researcher can create a profile and upload their publications. So it's up to them what they want people to see, so the privacy issue that we've been talking about. Well, it's up to you. Do you want people to see your home phone number and your mobile number and your pet's name? Then that's your choice. Otherwise, you can create that profile that is private and not show some of these things. Now, you can upload any of your publications, but obviously if you're a user of Web of Science, then we're able to take the citations from Web of Science and create some metrics for you as well. Now, what we're working with UQ is how can we work with all the information they've got already in their repository and feed that into the registry. Now, one of the things that's come up time and time again is, well, I'm a researcher, I'm really busy, I don't want to be doing this. So it's how do we get the buy-in where they will spend the time to create a profile and upload their publications. Now, certainly, we've had a huge uptake so far. There's around 22 million users of Web of Knowledge globally, so technically every single one of them could go in and create a profile. But also, if you go into the Researcher ID website, you'll see that it's open to everyone. You don't necessarily have to be a customer of Thomson's to go in and create yourself a profile. Just going to show you some screenshots. So here's just the main page of Researcher ID. Now, to promote the collaboration tool, you can go in and have a look and search for someone if you know their name. Or you can also search for keywords they choose to enter into their profile or what institution they're in. So we know there's already lots of Australian institutions in there. So feel free to have a search and have a look. So here's just an example of the profile up there on the left. You can see that the profile's at the top and just contains some basic information about their name. Some of the other names that they go by, including if they've got what's Unicode compliance, if you've got a Chinese written name or an Arabic name, you can add that in as well. The subject areas that they're working in, some of the keywords that they use to describe their work, and then a list of their publications. Now, one of the things that we can do is using data from Web of Science is also look at who you're collaborating with. So, who are the other authors that you're working with? What are the other countries that you're working with? Who's citing your work? Now, what we've been able to do is also mash that together with the Yahoo Maps, so you can see, okay, well, these are the authors that are citing your work, and where are they based? And if you were to click on one of those tags, you can see exactly what article is citing you and where they're from and the names of the authors that are citing you. So really, it's a very exciting initiative. I think we're in a really unique position here in Australia with so much focus on research evaluation that we're able to work closely with people like UQ and our other customers to see what we can do to help in this community. So that was it, just a very short presentation just on Researcher ID. I don't know if there's any questions. Linda.
Yeah, I'll play devil's advocate. Do you find any people coming in and removing some of their publications from the list because they don't really want to have them attributed, even though they are their publications?
We haven't, I guess we can't physically go in and check everyone's profile to see what they're loading into their publications list. So we haven't seen any evidence of people being ashamed of some of their work and not being wanting to be linked to it.
It is possible for people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's within their control what they upload. So we're hoping that the community will make checks to avoid the opposite. If people are uploading publications that aren't their own but are highly citing, they think, hey, you know, that could be mine. Steve?
Sorry, yeah. Look, I'm still not clear what exactly you are doing.
The back end of the process is where we're actually producing protocols and open standards for bidirectional exchange of data between the systems. So we talked before about reusing the good records. One of the most accurate sources of records that we discovered when we were loading 30, 40,000 pieces of information into the repository was dealing with the data downloads that we got from searches from ISI. So we're talking about ways to take that information at a system level and produce content that will go backwards and forwards between the two systems, use those records as a source of checking whether or not this is in fact the right publication that belongs to this order. So we're looking at attribution, we're looking at saying, okay, in terms of qualifying a lot of the data that we already have or when someone comes to us, it's making it easier for us to populate not just our repository, but then also flow that into another system which might be a desirable end for the person producing that portfolio. So in turn, when we've created these records, if someone else was to sign up and use the same sort of project or the same sort of protocols, you could see those records, those publication records, flow into another repository or another system down the track. We also get access, well, we'll be looking at how we access some of those citation metrics and build a lot of that richness back onto our existing systems in a far more real-time way than necessarily, say, doing a single report and looking at what a point in time of a particular researcher was.
The identities at the record level in imprints to give.
Well, that'll be one of the ways of marrying that data back together, yeah. Simon?
So, it's a question too fast. So, say I'm a researcher from University of Queensland and I'm starting off like a holiday at the University of Melbourne for a few years. And I come down and I say to the administration, here's my research ID, I'd like to go and just download the publications and pop them into our publications reporting system. Presumably, would that sort of activity be part of what you're doing?
Absolutely.
So the second part of my question is, at the University of Melbourne, I freely give information about the metadata that I've collected onto People Australia and other services. And People Australia then on supplies that metadata to everybody else in the Australian community. So something that we did actually benefit from Thompson is now freely available as metadata out there in the world. Is that also okay?
Some of it will depend on where you source that data from too, because Picture Australia will also be presumably harvesting from us as an authoritative source.
Yeah.
So you may find that you're going to get the same data from many, many places.
Yeah, no, I don't mind about the data, but in terms of utilising a service such as Thompson to extract what is high-quality metadata into our systems and then pushing that metadata out for somebody else to reuse without necessarily
Is that part of the business? You're straying into contractual issues there, which I'm just, I'm really not qualified to talk about, but what it would
be.
That's
one of the things that we need to consider when we use information, say, from Thompson's into repositories, which get harvested, is that we do need to sort those sorts of issues.
Bear in mind, though, we're talking about information that is publicly available in Medica. We're not talking about necessarily making the citation data available. We're talking about facets of things that are already known. So.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether we'd actually got that far.
It's pretty early in a lot of this development yet, and one of the reasons I haven't shown you data flow diagrams or architectural diagrams is that we're still thrashing out a lot of what the actual process behind the scenes is going to be. But certainly in terms of delivering those workflows, I like to talk about a very big picture system, which will deliver a lot of these aims. James, you had a question.
Yeah, quickly to follow that one up, I mean, what you're really hitting is the redistribution requirements of the common open source licenses.
Mm.
If I give you some material, are you free to redistribute to anyone else? So that's what's at the heart of it, property issue.
Absolutely.
Two ones I want to come back to. I'm interested to know how many individual users have created profiles to date and how long has the service been running? I'm trying to get some sense of, I know you've got millions of records you've created internally, but how many people have involved it?
I don't actually have a figure. I can go back and find out for you. The service has been running for a couple of months, so maybe at the start of the year it was introduced, so it's fairly new. We've certainly had a lot of chats with Australian institutions with a lot of interest, but a lot of the institutions are waiting to see, well, how can we do this on a batch process to make it easier. But, I can find out and get back to you on that.
I've tried to get a sense of how the year is so far. And it seems to me a really interesting distinction we're going to need to think through as a community is when a university gives all that data to you and you create public records of it, that's different to when I, a researcher, chose to create a record for me.
Yeah.
And so that one's going to take care.
There's a very interesting distinction to be made as part of the process because it really is a voluntary opt-in. As I say, we're not going along and coercing you to do this. And because the university may choose to collect records rightly for its own purposes internally, doesn't necessarily mean that we will then be exposing that data. There is always an acceptance process that has to go through before that record will be passed over to someone like Thompson. So we're very cognizant of that boundary that has to be very carefully walked there.
I mean, it's potentially very useful for people to say, oh, it's all done for me. If I'm happy, I can press a button and that's public.
Yeah, that's right.
The other one I was going to, sorry to ask this one, but identity hijacking. I mean, how easy is it for me to pretend to be someone else and create profiles for them and put up information? If I know, Jiho, that you have an article published as whatever, as far as I can tell, there's nothing stopping me creating an account in your name and starting to add stuff to that.
There are checks in place in the background. I mean, so far there's been no Mickey Mouses or Donald Ducks or weird stuff going on. But, I mean, we're relying on the community making sure that the profiles are accurate.
Mm.
So I've always seen no evidence of that.
Let me be a little more specific.
Yes, you could go in and...
Obviously, but hijacking someone else, how would you know if I had created your profile?
We don't. If you want to go in and create a profile in someone else's name, there's nothing right now in place that we can stop that.
Mm. And that's one of our concerns about dealing with a sense of what's an appropriate and what's an authoritative identity behind the scenes. Certainly when we're talking about exposing data and getting data back, we've got a much better feel for how we manage to map some of those attributes together. You know, simply using an email address is insufficient. Of course, it's obvious. But in many cases, you know, that's the sort of a place where you start and then build up to a more concrete, more rounded sense of what, you know, what is the definitive identity behind that profile.
How are you dealing with individuals who belong to this place that are not well represented?
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge for us. And fortunately, we can still upload those types of publications. We won't see the same sorts of metrics necessarily or the same sorts of analysis at this point. No, that's entirely correct.
My question relates to that in terms of GHO. What sort of checks and measures are being made for when people are uploading citations that aren't in concert? I mean, we've been finding academics aren't particularly good at citing themselves. So if they're getting data that's not verified, who is actually getting data
again? Again, it is relying on the author knowing their own work and being able to cite it correctly. We're hoping that people can do that. Obviously, you know better. So, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it is up to the individual or to the institution to make sure that the data there is correct.
So is there a way for repository managers to correct some of the information?
Well, that's the purpose behind much of the batch flow work that we're actually developing at the moment, is to give a more controlled way of creating portions of those records or all of the records. It's really early days at this point, but certainly that would be the intention, that we can avoid some of those, you know, correctness quality issues.
It just seems to me between the two models that the University of Melbourne one, there's a lot more control over the information that's provided, and I'm just wondering about UQ's approach to quality control, given that individuals are putting their own data in. Mm. And then from the University of Melbourne, whether you mentioned in your presentation that individuals can, there's issues about who to contact if you want to change things, but is that an administrative, is it difficult to, for them to change their pages?
I imagine that there's the same amount of quality control at UQ as there are as findings, but one of the reasons is that we're both responsible for providing their key outputs. So as well as researchers entering in their own data, I imagine there's a second layer of administrative process where administrators look at it and they classify it in terms of their key reporting requirements and other stuff. So
so you do that for every record?
Yeah. For the purposes of the herd key reporting this year, there was quite a lengthy process of authority control and quality checking that went on. And then, you know, because the individual researchers might sometimes get some of the indicators wrong, particularly if they're putting things like SEOs on, there's another process which comes along and actually vets that before it becomes used. So the data that actually sits in the repository at the end of the day is typically of very high quality, and whilst the researchers may be responsible for creating the skeletal framework. It goes across the top of it.
Researchers that refused to impart?
No, we didn't actually. Yes, we should scoop.
Thank you, Andrew and Jim.